We are very pleased to be able to host our annual mini Tanakh Yom Iyun. Mini because it's a half day, not a whole day. And we have three special presentations. Each one will get their own introduction, but first we have Rav Nadi Helpcott, followed by Rabbi Josh Berman, followed by Q&A with the Tanakh faculty. My name is our own Rav Berman, who's on his way to the States. I'm just going to tell you very briefly about Rabbi Helpcott and let him use his time well. Rabbi Helpcott is a dear friend. We go back many years. He is, I would venture to say, one of the people who is one of the foremost Orthodox thinkers in the United States today, and has been part of a small group of people who over the course of the last 15, 20 years has created a revolution in learning Tanakh in yeshiva high schools and in general in North America. Revolution that took place here in Israel in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. Rabbi Helpcott, over the course of the last 20 years, has been part of creating in the United States. If any of you had a good Tanakh shiur in your high school, it's probably due in no small part, either directly or indirectly, to something that Rabbi Helpcott has done. Those of you who can find your way to Teaneck at the end of June, worthwhile going to a series of Yimei Iyun that he coordinates, brings hundreds of people from across the United States to come learn Tanakh on a level that they have no access to outside of that context. Rabbi Helpcott.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Grummet. I guess revolutions are in the air in the Middle East, so I guess I became a revolutionary. But thank you very much for that introduction. I would pay back the favor that Rabbi Grummet is also one of the foremost teachers of Tanakh and was also part of this revolution when he was an assistant principal and in his work in Jewish education, which is has been amazing and continues to be amazing. So, Tadar Rabah. It's always wonderful to be in Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi. I'm actually here for other reasons, but I always try to make some time. I'm sorry?
I forgot to introduce him as right. The chair of the Tanakh Department and Jewish Thought at Yeshivat Kol Vei Torah.
Thank you. Which is a rabbinical school in America, but I'm not here in that context of recruiting. I'm here to share some Torah with you. And it's always wonderful to be in Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi. There are many, many dear friends and teachers and mentors and from all different years, including your Rosh Yeshiva was a chavrusa of mine for about half a year when we were in Yeshivat Har Etzion together before he went off to the army and left me high and dry when he enlisted in Tzahal. So today, Rabbi Grummet asked me if I would speak for a few minutes about some of the methodologies of Chazal in terms of how they approached learning Chumash and some of the issues and Tanakh in their methodologies. Now, this is a very broad topic because, you know, people have written books and books and books about this, Professor Yitzchak Heinemann and others, about Darkei HaAgadah in the world of agadic material, the non-legal portion of Tanakh, and people have written tons and tons of books on the halachic material. How did Chazal get from Ukshartim La'ot Al Yadecha to Tefillin in the sense of, did they see it as Pshuto Shel Mikra? Did they see it as a Kabbalah? They had a tradition and then they kind of shoehorned it into the Psukim? Or was it Mamish, that's the way they read Psukim? So there's a lot of issues and a lot of methodologies. So I can only touch about on a few of them, just some of them. And so I wanted to share with you some of those and some of the interesting ones that, again, and we can talk about more in future years. But today we'll see how much we can cover in one session. So I wanted to start with a perek, which is very well known, a topic that's very well known, and to show you that Chazal were actually, so to speak, very much doing what today a lot of us do in that revolutionary approach to Tanakh. And the first topic I wanted to start with is the topic of patterning, of dmuyot, of characters in Tanakh, and to see characters in Tanakh where later authors of Tanakh, whoever wrote Sefer Shmuel, whoever wrote Sefer Malachim, whoever edited Sefer Divrei Hayamim went out of their way in the way that they present it, either emphasizing certain events that happened, using language that evokes previous stories in Tanakh, to try to make us connect between one story and the other. Now you know that that's like a very big deal in any modern study of Tanakh, trying to see the patterning between one story and another story. How this story plays off of this story, which plays off of this story. Chazal already were doing that. The thing is, Chazal were not always systematic in the way they did it. They did it much more hit and run. And what today people are trying to do in the study of Tanakh is do it much more systematically. So I'd like to look at, with you at an amazing keta in the Midrash on the story of Eliyahu. Everybody, I think, or most people have studied the narrative of Eliyahu. Eliyahu is a fascinating character. Eliyahu just shows up out of the blue. We don't know his parents. We don't know what he did as a kid. Where did he go to yeshiva in Israel? We don't know anything about him. He just shows up and says, you know what? There's going to be a famine here, and you guys are all in trouble. And he has to run away, and he runs away from Jezebel and Ahab, and God appears to him. Remember the narrative of Eliyahu? And he hides in a rock, and then God appears to him, and he says, Kano kineti l'Hashem, I've been the zealot for God. And then the story of the Baal, where he brings the Nevi Habal for a duel against him. And who's going to be the real Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem Hu Elokim, which we of course integrate into our liturgy on Yom Kippur, at the end of Yom Kippur. So listen to this amazing Chazal, which is cited in Yalkut Shimoni. The Chazal, which comes from Psikta Rabasi and other places. So the Midrash says, Zehu Shamar HaKatuv, Uvenavi He'elah Hashem Yisrael Mitzrayim, Uvenavi Nishmar. It's a pasuk in Hosea, in the middle of nowhere, right? How many people read Hosea? Even in the time of Chazal, not everyone was Bucky in Hosea. But Chazal like to start with psukim that are going to perk up your ears in the middle of nowhere and bring it back home. God took us out of Egypt with a prophet, and God protected us with a prophet. What is that referring to? Says the Midrash, Ubenavi he'elah Hashem ze Moshe, Ubenavi nishmar ze Eliyahu. God took us out of Egypt with Moses, and He brought us to and protected us in the land of Israel with Eliyahu. So the Midrash is already laying down that we, as readers, when we read the story of Eliyahu, we should think that we're going to see a patterning of the story of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's exactly what the Midrash chose to do. They choose to list 24 parallels. Now what's interesting is, and that's part of a little bit of the difference between the modern literary method of patterning and the Chazalian method of, if I can create a word, and that is, some of the Chazalian connections are a little bit stretched for our ears as modern literary readers. But it doesn't matter, because the idea is what's important here. That they saw Eliyahu HaNavi as patterned after Moshe Rabbeinu. And if you continue, Atam motzei shnei nevi'im amdu l'Yisrael mishivto shel Levi. So we start. Moshe was from Levi. Eliyahu acharon. Both of them were called messengers of God to save the Jewish people. Moshe ga'alam Mitzrayim, v'yata l'cha v'ashchal paro, v'eliyahu l'atid lavo, hine anochi sholeach lachem et Eliyahu hanavi. Fascinating. Chazal pick up on the word shaliach, shaliach. So far it's a little bit, it's not yet convincing. I think as we start, we feel it's a little bit arbitrary. How many times in Tanakh does the word shlichut appear? A lot. If you put it into your computer program, is this really convincing yet? No. But look what happens as we move further. Moshe galah Mitzrayim tchila od lo chazru v'nishtabdu v'mitzrayim. V'eliyahu kshi yigal otam min revi'it od einam chazru v'nishtabim elo tshuat olamim. Okay. Nice. V'yata, now it comes to the heavy-duty artillery. V'atam motzei, and again, it's interesting, if I was an academic scholar of Midrash, I would interestingly note that there's a kind of transition here. This was the original Midrash, and now it's kind of the secondary Midrash, or probably the other way around. This is the original part, the gar'in of the Midrash. And at a certain point, there was the beginning, the prologue that we just read, that was probably added to it. Listen to the core. Moshe, v'atam otzei shemoshe v'liyahu shavim zelzel chol davar. Let's list. Moshe Navi, v'liyahu Navi. Moshe nikra ish Elokim, v'liyahu nikra ish Elokim. Now we're getting a little bit more tight. Not that many people in Tanakh are called ish Elokim. Who's called ish Elokim besides Moshe and Eliyahu? Is Yoshua called ish Elokim? Got to check. Check your concordance. It's hard to... Now we're getting a little bit more tight. Not that many people are called ish Elokim. There are people called, but we don't know their names. There's a lot of anonymous. In Sefer Melachim, right? The guy who gets eaten by the lions. Remember that story? Remember that story? The guy who gets eaten by the lions? No?
Yeah, the Navi
Sheker. Yeah, the Navi Sheker. But we don't know what his name is. How many people do we actually know who they are? They have a real name. And they're also called Ish Elokim. Now we're getting a little sharper. The Midrash continues. Moshe ala lema'ala ve'eliyahu ala lema'ala shenemar vayhi behealot Hashemet Eliyahu. Now we're getting interesting. How many figures in Tanakh are described as having gone into what we would call Mechitzato Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as having gone into the precincts of the Lord, of God Himself? So we have Moshe, Moshe Nichnas El Ha'arafel Asher Sham HaElokim in Har Sinai, and Eliyahu is the one who leaves this earth in a Sa'ara, in a whirlwind, up to Shamayim. Midrash continues. Moshe haraget haMitzri. Moses killed the Mitzri. Eliyahu haraget Chiel. Shenemar vayasham bebaal vayamot. Moshe nitkalkel al yedei isha. Shenemar kirenu lo v'yochal lechem. The story when Moses runs away in Midian and he's taken care of by the daughters of Yitro. Ve'Eliyahu Allah. I'm sorry. Ve'Eliyahu Nitkalkel aydei hatzorfit. He was protected by the isha hatzorfit. Shenemar likchina li pat lechem. Moshe barach mipnei paro, ve'Eliyahu barach mipnei izevel. Moshe barach ubal be'er, ve'Eliyahu barach ubal be'er. Shenemar vayavo be'er sheva. Moshe amar, im kimot kol adam yimutun eile, ve'Eliyahu said the same thing. If God will give any water. And then we come to the, so to speak, their building. The really strong connections. Moses, it says, B'Moshe vayavor Adonai al panav, vayikra b'shem Hashem, u'Eliyahu v'hine Hashem over alav. God protected Eliyahu b'nikra tatsur in the cave there where Eliyahu went into, just as Moses, and God revealed Himself. B'Moshe Vayishma et hakol, he heard the voice of God. Ubeliyahu, he heard the voice of God. Moshe kines et Yisrael lifnei har Sinai. Moses gathered the Jewish people to prove and to see God's revelation. Ve'Eliyahu gathered them in Har HaKarmel. Moshe bi'er ovdei avodah zarah. Moshe killed the ovdei avodah zarah. Shenemar simu ish charbo yirecho. Ve'Eliyahu bi'er ovdei avodah zarah. V'tafas nevi'ei ha'baal u'shchatum. He also killed the ovdei ha'baal in Har HaKarmel. And it continues in that direction. And it actually quotes very similar language. It says there, Moshe kinei mi l'Hashem elai, who will come together with me? Ve'Eliyahu kinei v'yom Eliyahu l'chol ha'am. Moshe nitman ba'me'ara. V'samticha b'nikra tatsur. Ve'Eliyahu nitman ba'me'ara. Shnemar v'yavo sham el ha'me'ara v'yalen sham. Moshe vayavo el har ha'elokim, ve'Eliyahu vayavo ad har ha'elokim. Moshe ran away to the midbar, and Eliyahu ran away to the midbar. Etc., etc. Moshe arba'im yom v'arba'im layla lo achal. Ve'Eliyahu, it says, vayelech b'koach achilahi arba'im yom. So that's, of course, very, very interesting. So what I'm just trying to show here is the rabbis, Chazal, were very aware of the concept of patterning. That the text of the Tanakh goes out of its way in presenting what aspects of the life of a later biblical character appear are often to make sure that we, the reader, make sure that we understand Eliyahu HaNavi is a second Moshe. Eliyahu HaNavi is a critical figure in Jewish history. And one of the ways that you highlight that is by showing the patterning to the Adon HaNaviim. It goes from Moshe to Eliyahu to Yeshayahu to Yirmiyahu. That these are central figures that played central roles in Jewish history in terms of connecting Am Yisrael to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Brit. And the Brit was at stake. Remember, Eliyahu is... where does he show up all the time at? At a Brit. Eliyahu Malach HaBrit. He's the Kano Kaneti Lashem. Moshe Rabbeinu is the person of the Brit, who takes care of the Brit and breaks the Luchot HaBrit when he's angry. So the rabbis went out of their way in the Midrash to highlight that which was imminent in the text already of Tanakh. But this is something, as I said before, they don't always do it to this extent. This is a great Midrash. I mean, this is like a whole shiur you could publish in a journal today in terms of showing the literary parallels. Chazal often don't do it. They throw it in a word here, in a comment there. You have to uncover a Rashi here, a Rashi there. Here, they present it in its full force. So the first methodology that I want to encourage everyone to look for when they're learning Medrash Agada, or when they're looking at Chazals in Tanakh, is the idea of patterning. To see later patterns as playing off of earlier patterns. And this idea of recurring themes and recurring personalities is something very important. By the way, you should be aware that not only Chazal do this, but Lahavdil Elef Havdalot, our friends who left our religion, the Christians, do the same thing. When they wanted to present Jesus in the New Testament, they go out of their way to present him as a second Moses or a second Eliyahu. Many of the events that occur to Jesus in the New Testament are conscious patterning of Moshe Rabbeinu and of Eliyahu HaNavi. Because of course, if you want to sell Jesus to the Jews, how are you going to sell it? You're going to sell it by trying to highlight how in the same shalshelet, in the same tradition of the great prophets of Israel, this man is coming as well. And of course, we rejected that, but you understand the methodology is the same methodology. Patterning. So, in my imaginary backboard, one. Let's go to a second one. Everyone take out their Tanakh, please, or Chumash, and Breishit Perek Yutet. Breishit Perek Yutet. The second methodology I want to speak about is something Chazal were also very fascinated with, which is uncovering something which occurs in Tanakh, and that's the methodology of foreshadowing. If patterning is to work and to see how later events are playing off of earlier events, sometimes Chazal uncover for us paradigms of foreshadowing, where something happens in the life of an earlier figure or an earlier event, which is supposed to set us up and make us think about something for the future. Now, we, of course, are very familiar with that from the concept of Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim, where the events that happened to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are really kind of paradigms for the future. And some of those are kind of very obvious. I want to deal with one which is not so obvious. And again, to keep your ears and eyes open and think, where is Chazal getting this from? How did they read Tanakh with such open, interesting eyes? Perek Yutet is the story of Lot and the Malachim, the angels who come to tell Lot, we're about to destroy Sodom, and you better get out of here. And if you don't get out of here quick enough, you're going to be destroyed. Fine. So the Chumash says, "Vayavo shnei hamalachim Sedoma ba'erev, velot yoshev b'shar Sedom, vayar lot vayakam likratam." And he comes, and he says to them in Pasuk Gimel, "Vayivtzar bam ma'od, vayasurei la, vayavo el beito, vayas lahem mishte, umatzot afa, vayolcheilu." Does anybody recall, without looking if you have it in front of you, what Rashi says on that Pasuk? I'm sorry? U'pesach haya. You learned that in day school, right? And so, when you learned it in day school, so what did you think about that Medrash? Make no sense! Why? Because it says matzah! Because it says matzah, therefore it's Pesach! Come on! Come on! What is this, a game? Because it says matzah. Yeah, in antiquity they ate matzah. And probably their matzah tasted much better than our matzah. You know, their matzah, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of Rav Shabtai Rappaport. He's a very big Talmud Chacham here in Yerushalayim. And when he claims very strongly that our matzah is like not matzah at all. He says that what we really should be eating on Pesach is lafa. You know, the lafa, the temani matzah, the real soft matzah that probably, you know, which is quick. If you've ever, you know, if you've ever gone to Eretz Bereshit near Male Adumim, and they make the, you know, the matzah, the guy that looks like, supposedly looks like a Bedouin Abraham kind of Abrit, and he makes the matzah. You never went there? You've gone there, you know, and they give you the little olive one. My kids love that. Whenever I take them, that's the most fun part of coming to Israel. Okay? So, that's what matzah, probably some sort of lafa. So what's going on here? Matzah? That's why it's Pesach? Where did Chazal get such a thing? So the truth is that it's much deeper than that. Because Chazal, and this has been noted by a number of writers, a number of people have pointed this out, what Chazal were doing here, where they were reading the story very carefully, and what they... When they said Pesach Haya, it doesn't necessarily mean chronologically it was Pesach. But the paradigm of Pesach fills this entire chapter, both linguistically and conceptually. What do you have in this chapter? You have a chapter in which a grave destruction, a ma'apecha, is coming on this city. And it's interesting. V'Hashem himtir al Sdom. The only other place, the next time in Tanakh, where we have the language of Lahamtir, is of course in the Makot, that come upon Mitzrayim, the Barak. And what do we have here? We have a story at night, in a closed house, interesting, a Bayit Sagur, where Lot has brought them into the house, and he's fed them a meal of matzah, and outside, everyone wants to come and kill the people who are in the house, but they can't get. If you're in the house, you're protected. No, throw them out to us. La petach. Open that. But you can't get past the petach. The petach, the malachim are makeh. The malachim, they smite the threat that's trying to take the people out of the house, and they're protected in the house. And what do the malachim say? The malachim say, Hotzi'uhu, leave this place and run away. They leave as the middle of the night, or as the dawn is coming. They leave the town of Sodom, and they are saved from the destruction in Sodom because they are part of Beit Avraham. So Chazal, and if you look carefully at the story, you'll see a lot of literary echoes of the Pesach story already here. And so when Chazal, it's not just a little game because it has matzah. They read the entire perek very carefully and they saw the paradigm of a closed house, a bayit sagur, where the petach is that which divides between death and danger and safety inside, where there's a makkah that protects you from being, where you're told to leave the premises. Yitziat Mitzrayim, Yitziat Sodom, saves the family of Abraham, on the schut of Abraham. And because of that, they can continue. So Chazal here, this is a famous example, which is not so clear, of where Chazal worked in the model of foreshadowing, where they read a story carefully and they saw in it the seeds of what would happen in the future. All the other stories, like I said, of Masa, Avot, Siman Levin, are very obvious. It's obvious that, you know, Avraham going down to Egypt because of a Ra'av is, of course, is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen with Yosef, etc. And they're going to take the women and leave the men. I'm sorry. They're going to take the women and leave and kill the men like Avraham and Sarah. Okay. Third methodology that I'd like to speak about, which is the methodology of smichut parshiot and gap filling. Smichut parshiot and gap filling, which is actually 3 and 4. So again, let's take a look at a very famous one that most of us don't like when we learn it in day school, because we think it's crazy. And unfortunately, we think it's crazy because usually, unless you have a good teacher, a teacher often teaches it without understanding what is going on. I refer specifically to the story of Yitzchak and Rivka. Yitzchak and Rivka, that interesting couple from many perspectives. So, how old was Yitzchak when he got married?
40.
What does it say in Tanakh?
40.
How do I know?
It says 40 years old.
It says explicitly in Chumash. In which parak?
Chavav.
Let's see. Is that what it says? It says in Chavav that's how old Esav was. But it says in Chavhei. Actually in Chavhei. Ooh. Okay. So it says, Perek Chavhei Pasuk Chav. Vayehi Yitzchak ben arba'im shnah v'kachto et Rivka. So it says explicitly how old Yitzchak was. Very nice. How old was Rivka? Where does it say that?
Rashi.
So where did Rashi get that from? Now, of course, when we learn that, we go crazy. We go crazy because it's beyond our comprehension. What does that mean? A three-year-old getting married? What did Chazal? What's going on here? And I always tell teachers, you can't teach that unless you're going to be able to explain what were Chazal doing when they said something like this. So this is a classic example of the methodology of smichut parshiot. The rabbis believed very strongly that the Chumash is not simply a list of chronological events, right? That's one of the reasons why many of Chazal were very into the concept of Ein Mukdam Meuchar B'Torah. Because it's obviously not just a list of, and this happened then, but there's a higayon, there must be some sort of significance to why one story follows another story. So Chazal were very much convinced, many of Chazal, not all Chazal, but many Chazal were very convinced of the concept of smichut parshiot, that there is significance, and the truth is, we too today also believe that very strongly. That the way Tanakh chooses to present one thing after another is very significant. Now, sometimes it's significant for purely literary reasons. Sometimes it's significant for theological reasons. Sometimes it's significant for historic. I'll give you a wonderful example. Yitro begins with the story of Yitro coming and the love between Moshe and Yitro offering his services, right? All that beautiful stuff. There are many Chazal and many Rishonim who say that it's out of order. That it really happened post-Matan Torah, right? Many of you studied that in school. That the story of Yitro coming and helping Moshe organize the judicial system is post-Matan Torah. Why do so many people say that it's post-Matan Torah? What's the big reason why they would say such a thing? Because? Because Moshe's judging and he has shilas all day and all night and he can't sit. What is he judging if they didn't get the Torah yet? That's the big question. So the question, of course, still is, oh, ein mukdam uchar b'torah. Very nice. But why? I mean, why? You still to say ein mukdam uchar b'torah just as the beginning of an answer. Now you have to explain why would the Torah put it out of order? So the Ibn Ezra over there says a beautiful thing, which is very deep. He says, the truth is that it should have been in order, but there's a theological reason why God organizes the Torah this way. And that is, what is the last parasha of Parshat B'Shalach? The last story in Parshat B'Shalach? Amalek. What is the first story of Yitro? Of Yitro. There's a juxtaposition here of presenting the two extremes in terms of how the world will react to the mission of Am Yisrael. On the one hand, you have the extreme of Amalek. And one could somehow think that throughout history, every non-Jew is Amalek. And there are people that think that way. But says Tanakh, no. There's also going to be a different paradigm. There's a paradigm of Yitro, the Ohev Yisrael, the one who wants to help the Jewish people fulfill their mission. And the Ibn Ezra shows very beautifully, if you look throughout Tanakh, this is not just some Hasidish avort. This is Pshuto Shel Mikra, because he points out throughout Tanakh, Amalek and Yitro are always together. In the Brachot of Bilam, the B'nai Kaini, who are the descendants of Yitro, are blessed right next to the curse of Amalek. Reishit Goyim Amalek, then B'nai Kaini. In the story of Shaul, when Shaul is called upon to destroy Amalek, the first thing he's supposed to do is, he tells the B'nai Kaini, get out of the way because you're going to be killed. Throughout Tanakh, there's a kind of paradigm of a yin-yang between Amalek and Yitro. So coming back to home base here. So let's come back to home base here. Chazal were very struck by the Smichut Parshiot. What's Smichut Parshiot? So right before we find out about the birth of Rivka, we of course have the story of the Akedah. The story of the Akedah. One of the interesting phenomena in the Akedah is the total absence of Sarah. Sarah Imenu is missing the Akedah. It's an all-boys club. It's the father, it's the son, it's the Na'arim. There's no mention of Sarah. That piqued the interest of Chazal, number one. Number two, what is presented to us right after the Akedah? So the text tells us, Vayhi achar v'imeinu vayigad l'avram l'imor, hinei yaldam yilka gam hi banim l'menachor achicha, et utz b'choro v'et buz achiv, v'et k'muel v'yaram, v'et kesev v'et chazo v'et pildash v'et yidlaf, etc., etc., ubituel yalad, etc., etc. And then ufilak show, just parenthetically, notice how many children are born in this little section here? 12. In Tanakh, 12 is the symbol of a completed nation. Later on, Esav is also going to have, Ishmael has, a lot of them have 12. 12 is the symbol of Shlemut, in terms of nationhood. So, we find out Rivka is born right after, or we find out, right, and Abram finds out right after the Akedah. So Chazal were very struck by that. And they said, well, if the Akedah is presented right next to the birth of Rivka, there's a tremendous connection. It must be that Rivka was born right at the Akedah, which from a theological point of view is also very powerful. At the very moment when Abraham almost lost his very future, his one child that he has left, Yishmael is gone. But Yishmael's out of the family. The one child he's looking for, at that same moment, his relatives in Mesopotamia, they have a lot of kids. They're just popping them out. This one, and this one, and this one, and this one. Avram, because she has a child, and that child is almost dead, and they have children and children and children. Very powerful contrast. So Rivka is born at the same time as Yitzchak is having the Akedah. Oh, but then, what's the next Smichut Parshiot? How does Parshat Chayisara begin?
She dies.
How old is she when she dies? 127. Now, let's do a little bit of math. How old is Rivka when she has Yitzchak? How old is Sarah when she has Yitzchak? 90? How do you know?
How do you know? Where? Where do we know that? The truth is, it doesn't really say exactly when Yitzchak is born. It says that when the angel came, she said, she laughed and she said, "Halavein tishim." Somebody who's 90, are they going to have a child? So we assume that she's 90, or around 90 when she has the child. So if she is 127 when she dies, so how old was Yitzchak at the Akedah?
37.
Now, that's the assumption. The assumption is, because we did Smichut Parshiot, if Sarah dies at the same time that Rivka is born, at the same time the Akedah, A equals B equals C, transitive, so then she dies at the same time as the Akedah, which is great. Not great, obviously. We don't want anybody to die, but certainly not Sarah. But Sarah is dying because of the Akedah, which yields a tremendous amount of midrashic exuberance in terms of why is Sarah missing? She's missing because it was too overwhelming. And even when she hears about it, she faints and she dies, etc., etc. And our good friend Aviva Zornberg, you know, this is like a major area where she can develop beautiful, beautiful shiurim. And so, Chazal saw these three events as integrally connected. Birth, Akedah Yitzchak, the almost death and rebirth of Yitzchak. Birth of Rivka, death of Sarah. Birth, birth, death, death. It all gets mixed in together. Almost death, birth, birth. Very powerful. But if you accept that powerful theological literary connection, you have a price to pay. This is what we call the cost-benefit analysis of Parshanut. Because if you accept that Sarah dies at the same time that the Akedah happens, at the same time that Rivka is born, if you accept those three connections, then you have to assume that how old is Rivka when she's married? How old? Three. It's a result of the math. You understand? It's not that it says in Tanakh three. But if Yitzchak is born which is a fact, when Sarah is about 90, and if Sarah dies when she's 127, and Yitzchak and the Akedah and the death of Sarah happen at the same time, so then he was 37. And we know from Tanakh that he got married when he was 40. And we know from Tanakh it's presented that the birth of Rivka is right after the Akedah. So the math forces us to come to the conclusion. Now, that's the methodology that Chazal used, and they were willing to take the cost of the rationality of a 3-year-old getting married, which they didn't really care about, because of the benefit, if I can use that term, the cost-benefit analysis of reading Tanakh in such a way that the Smichut Parshiot is so powerful in terms of the message, in terms of the meaning, in terms of the depth of the experience of death, life, almost death, life, death, and its connection. Now, if you're a Pashtan and you do not like this, it's very simple to undermine this midrash. Because this midrash is predicated on two big assumptions. Assumption number one, that Rivka is born at the same time as the Akedah. Assumption number two, that Sarah dies at the same time that Rivka is born and the Akedah happens. If you sever any one of those assumptions, poof, this midrash, this result goes up in the air. And so the Ramban, for example, will say, what are you talking about? This makes, he says, on a pshat level, this is not what's going on here. On a pshat level, first of all, it never says in the Tanakh that Rivka was born at the same time of the Akedah. What does it say in Tanakh? It says after these things, who God la Avraham. Abraham is told. Now there was no SMS. And there was no texting in the time of Chazal. So Avraham, when did he find out? It could be 2 years later, 4 years later, 6 years later. You know, you should talk to people
before, you know, not even the time of Abraham. There are people who sometimes didn't find out what happened to their relatives, not during the Shoah, but just them. In Europe, it might take them 4 or 5 years to find out their uncle died, or this one had a child. Right? It just took a long time for news to get here. So it doesn't mean that Rivka was necessarily born at that time. Number one. Number two, who's to say that Sarah dies right at the time of the Akedah? Who's to say that? It could be that she died a few years after the Akedah, 10 years after Akedah. And what's the best proof that probably the death of Sarah does not occur at the same time as the Akedah? What's the best proof? The best proof? Location. Excellent. What do we mean by location?
Abraham goes back to
Be'er Sheva. And she's dying at Charon. So what is this? They have separate vacations? I mean, what's going on? They're living in two different places? Very difficult psukim. Chazal, a lot of them are first. The simple reading is, yeah, they were in Be'er Sheva for a couple of years, and then they retired. They sold their house, and they went to Hebron, and they got ready for, you know, what was going to happen in the future. So, this is an example of smichut parshiot, which Chazal really tried to develop and saw as pregnant with meaning and mashma'ut, and ultimately tried to teach us something. Yes?
Do they actually care, or do they have any tradition, like with all the details that they seem to be making up, like the fact that we've got slavery, or...
No, so I said, it's not that they make... It's a result of certain exegetical assumptions.
I'm saying, do they either care, do they, like...
So
I personally think
that in this case, I don't think it's very hard to say with, you know, you can't make a broad brush and say that in every case. I think that in this case, it wasn't that the masoret about her being three came first. It was the other way around. First, they analyzed the psukim and the smichat parshiot, and that resulted in this conclusion. But it's not the other way around. Sometimes one has to admit that, yes, maybe they had a tradition about certain historical events that were passed on from generation to generation, but you can't necessarily know for sure. There's no way to tag it and say, this is this and this is that. In this case, I think that it resulted more from the parshanut than from the other way around.
Is there any distinction that we can tell?
No, I don't think that we can, unless there is absolutely no exegetical hook in the text that may have brought it to that. Then you could say probably they had some sort of masoret that goes back. And one of the things you have to do if you're interested in this is you have to see how far back it goes. The stuff before Midrash, all what we call today the Sifrut Bayit Sheni, the Second Temple literature, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Book of Jubilees, and anything else which was written before the texts of our Midrashim, Philo, Pseudo Philo, Artaphanos, all these books which are out there, which give us a window into what Jews and Hellenistic Jews and non-Jews thought. So when you start to read that stuff and you see certain traditions, so that gives you a sense that, you know, maybe it has a very ancient provenance. It started a long time ago, these Midrashic, Agadic traditions. But sometimes you don't find it until very late. Okay. Now, let's... the final one I'd like to speak about is just simply something that a good friend of mine, Yitzhak H. Shalom, and others have written about, is simply... sometimes just the methodology of the parshanut hamikra of Chazal, that simply Chazal engaged in parshanut, the way we engage in parshanut, exegesis, and how they connected things from one thing to another. Last year I spoke about Avram and Gidon, and I don't want to talk about that, but I want to talk about the end of that medrash, the medrash, of course, that we all know about Avraham and Nimrod. That Avraham and Nimrod were, right, they almost, you know, they clashed. In the Midrash, Nimrod wants to kill Abraham and throws him into burning fire. Where does that come from? I mean, it's a wonderful image. But where in the text did Chazal see themselves able to develop that theme? So, probably, if you want to if you don't believe it's just some stam, either it's a tradition that they had, and if you don't want to just say they just made it up one day, no, they had nothing better to do, I don't believe that's the way Chazal operated. They read the text like we read the text, and sometimes they tried to understand certain anomalies in the text. I think Chazal was struck by a couple of interesting things. What is one of the things that we know about Nimrod? What do we know about Nimrod from Tanakh?
He's a great warrior.
He's a great warrior before Hashem, but what else? What else do we... Something else that is just hinted at. What else do we know about Nimrod? He's a great warrior. He's in Bavel. Interesting. What else? Vatihi Reshit Mamlachto Bavel. Fascinating. If I'm not mistaken, Nimrod is the first person who is mentioned as being a melech in Tanakh. He's a melech. He's the first person who... I can't say he developed the institution of monarchy, but he certainly is the first person mentioned in the Bible as being a king. Interesting. Now, so we have a king who happens to live in the territory of Bavel. Interesting. Eretz Shinar. Interesting. And this king is a gibor. What does it say? Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem, which is an interesting term, especially given everything we've seen up until this point in the book of Genesis, and the fact that in this place they make the Migdal Bavel. It doesn't sound like this Nimrod is associated with such a great kind of place. The Giborim Anshei Hashem are not good people in chapter 6 of Genesis. Remember those guys? The guys who take the women whenever they want, the B'nai Elohim and the B'not Adam, and they're the Anshei Hashem, which they were the Giborim, the Anshei Hashem. It's not such a great thing to be the Giborim. And the people of Bavel, they want to make themselves a shame. Naselanu shame. They want to challenge God. This is who Nimrod is coming from. Also the fact that he's a melech. Melech is not always such a great thing to be in Tanakh. Certainly many figures in Tanakh do not like Malchus, Shmuel, the most prominent amongst them. To be a king is a very challenging thing. I don't mean just because, you know, you can get deposed. It's challenging because the whole institution of monarchy gets at the whole roots of, what do you mean you want to be a king? God is Hashem hu malkechem. God is your king. Fundamentally, the kingship is a very ambivalent phenomenon. It's a concession. God says, yeah, they need a king. But kingship is a very, very ambivalent institution in the Bible. And in the Bible, Malchus totally doesn't work either. I mean, in Tanakh, it's a disaster, say for Malachim. Except for a little nekudot or here and there. If you just look at it from hindsight, it's a total disaster. Malchut Yisrael and Malchut Yehuda. And so you have this king, Nimrod, in Bavel. Interesting. And Chazal saw themselves, interestingly here, Avraham is also a quasi-king. Nesi Elokim Ata B'Tochenu. Avraham, when he beats the four kings and the five kings. He beats the four kings and the five kings. Just parenthetically. Who should win in a battle between four and five?
Five.
But who wins the battle of the four kings and the five kings? Why? Why? They're bigger armies, obviously. It's like Toledo and Cleveland and, you know, Topeka, Kansas fighting, because they were just little city-states. They were fighting the five kings of Melech, of Shinar. They were fighting, you know, like the United States, Russia, and China. It's a crazy thing. So it's not four versus five. Okay. Anyway, it's the four kings of nations versus the five towns. They were the five towns. That's what it says there. Five towns. They were all evil. It says there in Tanakh. It says Anashim Ra'im Achataim LaHashem Ma'od.
I didn't say it. It says in the Torah there. It says, think about it. What's the name of the king of Sodom? The name of the king of Sodom is Bersha, Bera, and the king of Amorah is Birsha. These guys are, you know, they're bad guys. Anyway, so Tanakh here sets up a conflict. In a sense, what Chazal were reading something very deep. Avraham is a quasi-king. He beats the four kings and the five kings. They come to Enoch HaMelech. And remember the Chazal that says they wanted to anoint him as king over all of Mesopotamia. So he's a quasi-king against the bad king, Nimrod. So you understand where Chazal were coming from. And you understand also, a king from Bavel, the first king of Bavel, who's the, so to speak, last king of Bavel that we find out about in Jewish history? Nebuchadnezzar. And what did he do, the last king of Bavel? He threw a couple of Jewish children, Jewish teenagers, into a fire. Melech Bavel, Melech Shinar. That's where Chazal. And then we have, fascinating, Avraham says, Hashem says to Avraham, Anochi Hashem asher utzeiticha me'ur kazdim, who took you out of Ur Kasdim. Very strange phrase. What do you mean, Hotzeiticha mi'ur kasdim? I didn't take you out. I said to you, Lech lecha me'artzecha. I gave you a command. Asher tziviticha. What's asher hotzeiticha? Chazal read it. When's the other time when we say, Anochi Hashem lokecha, asher hotzeiticha, I saved you from Egypt. Chazal heard all these echoes, and therefore they read with a very serious ear that there seems to be echoes of Avram being saved from a place of danger. And where do we see a king who put the Jewish people in danger? The one who threw, the Melech Shinar, who threw. So this is an example of Parshanut of Chazal. So today, what we did in our short time together, we looked at five methodologies that Chazal were very into in the Midrashei Agadah. We did not do any Midrashei Halakha today. That's for another time. We looked at patterning. We looked at foreshadowing. We looked at smichut parshiot. We looked at gap filling. And we looked at some of the methodologies of Parshanut HaMikra of Chazal. I tried to choose things which were a little bit famous, but also a little bit hard. Not the easy things. And hopefully you enjoyed it. And hopefully it's important when we look at Chazal to take them seriously. Not always literally, but to take what Chazal say seriously and think about what may have been the thought process in which they read the text that may have led them to the conclusions, just like when we read the text of Chumash and try to get beyond it and try to see what the text is trying to teach us and trying to enlighten us with. It's wonderful. I wish everybody a great year and success in all your learning and everything else in your experience here in Israel.